Opening narration.
Akhotra Foundation presents The Akhotra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI.
Introduction.
Welcome back. Today we're diving into a really fascinating spiritual memoir, C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy, The Shape of My Early Life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people know Lewis for, you know, Narnia, or maybe his scholarly work at Oxford and Cambridge, or even his Christian apologetics, like Mere Christianity.
Right. He wore many hats, right. Influential figure.
Exactly. But today we're focusing on perhaps his most profound identity shift, how he went from being, in his own words, a militant atheist to becoming arguably one of the most influential Christian writers of the 20th century. It's quite the journey.
It really is. And this book, Surprised by Joy, it's not your standard A to B biography. It's very introspective.
All right.
Lewis is basically mapping his own internal intellectual and spiritual battles. And our mission here is to track this one specific, recurring, almost elusive feeling he calls joy.
And it's crucial to get this joy isn't just feeling happy, like when things are going well.
No, not circumstantial happiness.
Or physical pleasure either. It's something different, deeper.
Much deeper. More like a longing and intense, almost painful desire for, well, for something you can't quite name or find on earth.
So the core idea we're unpacking is that Lewis spent years running away from God, intellectually and emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Actively resisting.
Only to find out, rather reluctantly, that the very thing he was running from was the source of this transcendent ache, this joy that he'd been chasing his whole life through books, nature, mythology, everything but God.
It's a profound irony. The thing he chased was actually pointing back to the thing he fled. Okay, let's chase how this happened.
The chronological journey.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning.
Yeah.
The formative years.
Mm.
Lewis, or Jack, as his family called him, born 1898 in Belfast. His childhood home, Little Lee, sounds quite comfortable, bookish.
Very much so. He paints this picture of an early idol, lots of books, imagination, running wild. He and his older brother, Warney, even created this incredibly detailed fantasy world called Boxen. It was their escape, their private universe.
A safe haven. But yes. That didn't last, did it?
No. It was shattered. Two major events, really. The first, absolutely devastating, was his mother Flora's death from cancer when he was only 9.
Just 9? That's incredibly young to lose a parent.
And it hit him hard. Not just emotionally, but theologically, too. He prayed, you know, prayed desperately for her to be saved, and his prayers went unanswered.
So that's the seed of doubt right there.
Mm-hmm.
The first crack in any childhood faith.
You could say that it introduced this deep sense of instability, this feeling that the universe maybe wasn't benevolent or even ordered. It felt chaotic, cruel even.
And the second event followed directly from that.
Yes, losing his mother led to him and Warney being sent away to English boarding schools. And for Lewis, this was basically exile, the start of a really unhappy period. He describes his first school, Wynyard, which he calls Belson in the book, a pretty stark comparison.
Wow, yeah.
As just soul-crushing, bleak, conformist, intellectually deadening. And it was in that grim atmosphere that his atheism started to really take root, less from argument initially and more from just despair, really.
Oh.
But here's the fascinating twist. Even in the midst of all this misery and loss, this is when he first experiences what he later identifies as joy.
Really?
He tells the story, it's quite famous, about remembering a miniature garden his brother had made years earlier. Just moss and flowers and a biscuit tin lid.
Okay.
And the memory of it years later suddenly hits him with this sharp, piercing stab of longing. Not just nostalgia, but this intense desire for something. Well, something other, something nameless, beautiful, almost otherworldly that the little garden only hinted at.
So it wasn't happiness about the garden. It was the garden triggering a desire for something beyond it.
Exactly. It's a key distinction. The garden wasn't the thing. It was the pointer. So you have this push and pull, the trauma pushing him away from easy answers, but these fleeting moments of intense longing pulling him towards something transcendent.
Okay, so his atheism is growing, fueled by misery and unanswered prayer. But it wasn't yet intellectually solidified, right? That came later.
Right. The real intellectual hardening came when he started studying privately with William T. Kirkpatrick, his father's old headmaster. Lewis called him the Great Knock.
The Great Knock. It sounds formidable.
Oh, he was. A staunch rationalist, a confirmed atheist himself, and an absolute rigorous logician. Think Socrates, but maybe less patient.
Okay.
Kirkpatrick's method was relentless questioning. He demanded absolute precision, logical proof for every single statement Lewis made, no room for fuzzy thinking, emotion, or assumption.
So he basically trained Lewis to be an intellectual weapon.
Pretty much. He hammered out the dreamy, romantic side and forged a sharp, analytical mind obsessed with logical consistency. Kirkpatrick effectively gave Lewis the intellectual framework for his atheism, made it rigorous, defensible.
But the irony is just huge, isn't it? The man who cemented his atheism also gave him the exact tools he'd later use to dismantle it.
Precisely. That's the crucial point. Kirkpatrick taught him to follow logic wherever it led, even to uncomfortable conclusions. And eventually, Lewis found that logic, rigorously applied, led him somewhere Kirkpatrick never intended and somewhere Lewis himself didn't want to go.
Core philosophy and values.
Yeah.
Implicitly linked to joy.
Okay, so this concept of joy seems central. Let's nail down what Lewis meant by it, because it's kind of the engine of his whole spiritual journey, isn't it? It's his core driver in a way.
Absolutely. He uses the German word Sehnsucht sometimes, which captures that sense of longing or yearning. For Lewis, joy wasn't about having something. It was about the wanting.
The wanting itself.
Yes. An intense, sweet, but also painful ache. An inconsolable longing, he called it. It's the feeling you get when you glimpse something beautiful. A landscape, a piece of music, a line of poetry, and it evokes this deep sense that what you really want is just beyond your grasp. It's a signal of
Unlike happiness or pleasure, which are about satisfaction.
Exactly. Happiness depends on things going well. Pleasure depends on sensory input. Joy, for Lewis, was independent of those. It could arrive unexpectedly, even in bad times, and it always left you feeling, well, wanting more. But not more of the thing that triggered it, more of the source it pointed to.
Which leads us to his big philosophical argument, the argument from desire. Can you break that down?
Sure. It's actually quite elegant, logically. Lewis basically says, look around. Humans have innate desires. We feel hunger.
And there's food.
Right. Yeah. We feel thirst.
And there's water.
We have desires for companionship, for knowledge, for sex. And there are corresponding realities in the world that can, at least partially, satisfy those desires.
Okay, makes sense. Natural desires point to natural fulfillment.
Precisely. So Lewis then asks, what about this other desire, this universal deep-seated longing for something transcendent, this thing he calls joy? If this desire exists in practically everyone, across cultures and times.
Then it seems illogical, he argues, to assume it's the one desire that points to absolutely nothing, the one desire with no possible fulfillment.
Exactly. He's saying, if we have this profound homesickness for a country we've never seen, maybe that homesickness is evidence that such a country actually exists. Joy, therefore, isn't just a psychological quirk. It's a clue, a divine signpost.
Pointing towards God.
Pointing towards its origin, towards the reality that could ultimately satisfy that deep longing. So his core philosophy, driving his search, was this relentless pursuit of the source of joy, coupled with this bedrock belief instilled by Kirkpatrick that reason and evidence must be followed.
Three pivotal turning points.
All right, let's pinpoint the key moments, the turning points that really shifted things for him on this journey from atheism back towards faith. What was the first major catalyst?
I think the first one has to be encountering the work of George MacDonald, specifically his fantasy novel, Fantasties.
Ah, MacDonald. Another fantasy writer. Important connection there with Narnia later.
Huge connection. Lewis said reading Fantasties baptized his imagination. Before that, he sort of saw reason and imagination as separate, maybe even opposed. Rational thought was serious. Myth and fantasy were enjoyable, but ultimately untrue.
Okay.
MacDonald showed him that wasn't necessarily the case. That myth and story could convey deep truths, could resonate with reason, could even be a vehicle for understanding reality in a way pure logic couldn't. It opened a door for him the idea that the imaginative and the rational weren't enemies. It allowed his longing side and his logical side to start talking to each other.
Okay, so that's one imagination gets baptized. What's the second turning point?
The second, I'd say, was the influence of his friends at Oxford, specifically other academics who were brilliant, rigorous thinkers, and also devout Christians.
Like J.R.R. Tolkien.
Exactly. Tolkien, Hugo Dyson, Owen Barfield, these were men whose intellect Lewis deeply respected, and they were believers. This directly challenged his long-held prejudice.
Which was?
That, you know, religious faith was basically for the less intelligent or the emotionally needy or people who hadn't thought things through rigorously.
Right, a common stereotype.
But he couldn't dismiss Tolkien's mind. He couldn't dismiss Dyson's. Having these sharp, rational colleagues who also possessed deep faith forced him to confront the possibility that his atheism wasn't the only intellectually respectable position. It eroded his confidence in that prejudice. The evidence was right there in the faculty lounge.
Okay, imagination opened up. Intellectual prejudice challenged. What was the third critical moment? The final push.
The third is really the culmination, the actual conversion, which happened in two distinct stages. First, the reluctant acceptance of theism in 1929.
Theism, meaning a belief in a god, but not necessarily Christianity yet.
Correct. This was purely intellectual for him at first. He described feeling like a mouse being hunted by a cat, God being the cat, methodically checkmating him. All his arguments against God's existence had crumbled under his own logical scrutiny. He famously wrote, "In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God." Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
Dejected and reluctant. Not exactly a joyful surrender.
Not at all. He felt cornered by logic. But that wasn't the end. The final step, the conversion to Christianity, came about 2 years later in 1931. And the catalyst here was that famous late night conversation with Tolkien and Dyson.
What happened in that conversation?
They talked about myth. Lewis loved myths, Norse, Greek, but saw them as beautiful lies. Tolkien and Dyson argued that the story of Christ was the true myth. It had the power and resonance of myth, but it was unique because it actually happened in history. It was myth become fact.
Bridging that gap between story and reality.
Precisely. And Lewis said the realization didn't hit him like a thunderbolt during the conversation. It settled quietly afterwards. He describes riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle on the way to Whipsnade Zoo.
An ordinary moment.
Utterly ordinary. And he says, "When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. No emotional drama, just a quiet shift. Like waking up and realizing you're awake. That was the final piece falling into place."
Human lessons and reflection.
So looking back at this whole intellectual and spiritual wrestling match, what are some of the key human lessons we can take away? What does Lewis's experience teach us, you know, today?
Well, I think one of the most powerful lessons is about intellectual honesty. Lewis genuinely seems to have followed the arguments where they led, even when it took him somewhere he didn't initially want to go.
Right. He resisted emotionally, but his commitment to reason, ironically drilled into him by an atheist, wouldn't let him off the hook.
Exactly. He models the idea that you don't have to choose between having a sharp mind and having faith. He demonstrates that reason, followed rigorously, can actually lead towards faith, not away from it. He embodies the thinking believer.
That's a really important counter-narrative to the idea that faith and reason are always enemies.
Definitely. And tied to that is his challenge to what he called chronological snobbery.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that. Explain that again. It feels very relevant now.
It's the assumption, often unconscious, that whatever is newer ideas, beliefs, values, is automatically better or truer than what came before, simply because it's modern.
Like assuming we're automatically smarter than people from the past just because we live later.
Pretty much. Lewis warned against this arrogance. He argued we should engage with older thinkers and texts, assuming they might actually know things we've forgotten, that wisdom isn't tied to a specific century. It's a call for intellectual humility, really, to learn from the past, not just dismiss it.
That's a good challenge for all of us, I think. But we also need to add a layer of critical reflection here, don't we? This book, Surprised by Joy, is presented as this clear intellectual journey towards joy and God.
Mm-hmm.
But Lewis deliberately leaves out huge parts of his personal life, most famously his very long and complex relationship with Janie Moore, the mother of a friend killed in the war. How does knowing about these omissions change how we read his narrative of conversion?
It's a crucial point. It reminds us that Surprised by Joy is not a full tell-all biography. It's a curated account. Lewis constructed it very carefully to make a specific philosophical and theological argument, using his life as the primary evidence.
So it's an argument in the form of a memoir.
Exactly. He selected the details that serve that argument, the pursuit of joy, the intellectual battles, the conversion. He omitted things like the complexities of his domestic life with Mrs. Moore that might complicate that clear narrative arc or weren't directly relevant to the specific spiritual point he was making.
Does that invalidate the argument?
Not necessarily invalidate it, but it adds important context. It shows us Lewis, the rhetorician, the master communicator, shaping his story for a purpose. It means we should read it, understanding its specific focus and recognizing it doesn't capture the entirety of his lived experience, which was, like anyone's, probably much messier and more contradictory than the book suggests. It highlights the human element in constructing even a narrative about divine truth.
Three final takeaways.
Okay, let's try to crystallize this. If someone listening were to take away just three key things from Lewis's journey as told in Surprised by Joy, what would they be? Let's start with maybe an emotional insight.
The most emotionally powerful lesson, I think, is the nature of that deep, inconsolable, longing joy, or Sehnsucht. Recognizing that ache not as a sign of something wrong with us, but perhaps as a universal human signal, a homesickness pointing towards something transcendent, something more real than our immediate experiences. It validates that feeling of, is this all there is?
Okay, that's powerful. What about an intellectual insight? What's the key takeaway for the mind?
Intellectually, it has to be the rigorous application of the argument from desire. The idea that our deepest, innate, universal longings likely correspond to a reality capable of fulfilling them. It's a challenge to purely materialistic worldviews, suggesting that our inner lives, our deepest desires, might actually be reliable clues about the nature of reality itself. It puts desire on the map as philosophical evidence.
Right, using reason to argue for something beyond the purely physical. And finally, a universal insight, something practical we can all apply.
Universally, I think it's the commitment to following the evidence, even when it's uncomfortable. Lewis modeled intellectual honesty even when it led him to abandon his cherished atheism. The lesson is to be willing to question our own assumptions, challenge our biases, including that chronological snobbery, and have the courage to change our minds if the evidence points that way, regardless of our emotional preferences. It's about integrity in the pursuit of truth.
Closing narration.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.